Mr. Jacobs, I think you are very optimistic when you give the Soviets a possibility of achieving superiority only by 71-73. There is unfortunately a good chance that they have it by the end of this year. They will celebrate the next election, I presume. Our next speaker is Professor Quan Li Wu, who was born in Tianjin, China. He has the distinction of being a PhD from the London School of Economics, very proudly was listening to Professor Hayek. And he's now Professor of International Business at the University of San Francisco, but also, and to my heart, much closer to my heart, a consultant to the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace, where he directed a recent project on arms control in the Far East and Chinese areas. Professor Wu also has the distinction that he has worked up, in connection with the Stanford Research Institute, a large study on Chinese economy and industry, which is one of the major inputs in the knowledge which the Pentagon has on this mysterious land which we call China. In fact, I think it is hardly an exaggeration to say that Professor Wu is the country's outstanding expert on the Chinese economy. I have known about Professor Wu long before I had the pleasure of meeting him, many, many years ago, and I read a book which I recommend to all of you, which is titled Economic Warfare. That's a subject which right now is often forgotten, that economic warfare is going on all the time, but it is, and he laid down there some of the basic principles of this unlovely type of activity. His most recent book, which I haven't seen yet, is The Special Economy of Communist China, published by Prager. Professor Wu also has written many articles and periodicals, including the interesting piece in Orbis several years ago, in which he explained that the capability of the Chinese to intervene effectively in Vietnam was pretty close to zero. Professor Wu.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, when I was first asked to come to this meeting, I had not yet seen the program. And after I saw the program, I made sure that I would not miss it, as I wanted very much indeed to see my professor at London, Professor Hayek, under whom I studied for my PhD. Now, I would like to talk a little bit about the impact of Chinese policy on the rest of the world, and especially on the United States. And I consider this as this impact as a function of Peking's long-term goals of its military capability and of its perception of the external world with which it has to deal, including the capability and state of mind of its antagonists. About the goals of Peking, I think what Professor Jacobs has said of the Soviet Union applies equally. More immediately, it is to erode the influence of the United States in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, which are called the storm centers of world revolution. And for Peking also, it is an objective to weaken Soviet influence in the international communist movement, particularly in Asia, though not exclusively in Asia. Now, it's all very well to say, here are these goals. How capable are the communists in China to achieve these objectives? We hear today of two opposite views. On the one hand, we hear people say that the Chinese have come to age in nuclear development and therefore pose a threat, and that as soon as they are able to develop and deploy an ICBM system, we are in for it. Then on the other hand, there are others who say that look at what is going on and has been going on in China for the last couple of years under the slogan of the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. And things are all messed up and China poses no threat whatsoever. Neither view is, in my opinion, quite accurate. There is a little truth in each, but the story is much more complicated. And for this reason, I feel that I have to devote just a few minutes to some of the internal problems and goings on in the Cultural Revolution of 1960, that began in the winter of 65-66 and has been continuing to this day. I want especially to examine the developments in order to determine what has happened or is likely to happen to the leadership in Peking and what has happened and is likely to happen to the economic base of China and the capability to support a military expansion program. In spite of our lack of full information on the Cultural Revolution, certain events stand out quite clearly. And one of these events is the gradual broadening of the list of targets of attack in the Cultural Revolution by the revolutionary group. The initial targets of the revolution were the party leaders and party cadres at different levels. They included especially those who were employed in the propaganda, so-called cultural and communications departments. The attack was spearheaded by student Red Guards and other rebel groups, apparently with the logistic support of army units for feeding and transportation. During the summer and fall of 1966, large numbers of Red Guards traveled to Peking and throughout the country to demonstrate, to pressure party and administrative officials, and to, quote, exchange revolutionary experiences. This was the initial stage. Then by the winter of 66-67, the attack was widened to include the management of factories and enterprises, and poor and lower middle peasants. These are special terms that the Chinese use. These poor and middle peasants, lower middle peasants, were instructed to carry on similar revolutionary activities on the farms. This broadening of the objects of attack was followed at the time of spring sowing in 1967, that's about the time a year ago, by the dispatch of the army to the countryside, ostensibly to help with the pressing farm work. The PLA, People's Liberation Army, was soon given a rapidly expanding role in maintaining order and in safeguarding production. Through the summer and fall of last year, there were reports of active fighting, disruptions of transportation and industrial production, and clashes between peasants and the revolutionary groups. There were a few major outbreaks involving the army itself. Then by September 1967, and in the months that followed, the role of the PLA was strengthened still further. Its new assignment was to help organize the so-called three-way or tripartite alliances, that is, including the military, the revolutionary groups from the outside, and the activists within each individual unit where of production, of enterprise, of government agency, and whatever, where these tripartite alliances are to be formed. So the Army's new assignment was to help organize these alliances throughout the country and to engage in criticism, refutation of revisionism, and rehabilitation of those who had erred in an all-embracing movement of revolutionary alliance. On the one hand, the people were told that they should love the Army, love the PLA. On the other hand, the PLA was instructed to put the house in order. Now, this resume of events permits us to reconstruct the following interpretation of economic development. And this will lead us to some further conclusions in a minute. First of all, what happened in 1966? The concentration of the initial attack on the party committees and the secretariats at different levels, especially the propaganda departments, was easily understandable, that is with the benefit, of course, of hindsight, because these organizations constituted the depositories of political power in China, and they provided immediate support for those members of the Central Committee of the Communist Party who had been singled out for replacement by Mr. Mao. Furthermore, for the Cultural Revolution effort to succeed, it was tactically necessary to establish a monopoly of the communications media. Now, the targets selected in this way and the means employed, that is, the use of the Red Guard in their attack, had two economic consequences. On the one hand, the CPC members, the party members under attack, had mostly held positions of authority for a considerable time, and it is only natural that they would have their own followings, their underlings, their allies, and that these people would be found among the many administrators and managers of government enterprises and agencies. Both for self-preservation and as a tactical riposte, this group could therefore be expected to try to confound their attackers through confusion and infiltration. Therefore, the official organ of the Communist Party, the People's Daily, which was under Mao's control, was moved to accuse the opponents of fanning opposition to the Cultural Revolution among the country's workers. They had also been charged with having deliberately organized their own Red Guards, led demonstrations, and encouraged travels to Peking, which of course blocked out the transportation network. It was quite clear that the rampaging and traveling Red Guards blocked up rail transport, and together with clashes with workers, created work stoppages in a number of cities. But there was very little evidence that would point to prolonged disruptions of work. There may have been disruptions, but they were not prolonged. In general, agricultural production during 1966 did not appear to have been affected seriously at all. Industrial production and transportation suffered, but only during the latter half of the year, and perhaps not in many places or for protracted periods. Foreign trade during the year actually rose to a record level of $4.2 billion worth, including both imports and exports. So we can conclude that the Cultural Revolution did not affect noticeably the level of aggregate economic activity during the first year. But things were a little different in the second year. The steps taken by the Maoists in the winter of 66-67 in response to what they felt was the opposition's tactics had a far greater effect on production than before. The extension of activities to the industrial sector and the intensification of similar activities on the farms were, of course, disruptive. The PLA was brought in to restore order and to impose unity. And the struggle began to take on greater proportions of violence. And throughout 1967, there were contradictory reports on industrial production. We had reports that things were doing very well in some factories as a result of Mao thought. And we had other reports pointing to exactly the opposite. The general impression one gets is that industrial production during the year was a spotty one, that there probably was not much progress. On the other hand, there was, again, was no evidence of any serious cutback in production which could be regarded as having permanent effect. You read about reports of clashes which stopped production, but you have not seen any report whatever of actual destruction of facilities. In the agricultural sector, we had official reports that the summer harvest was some 10% above the figure in 66. Then we had reports that the early autumn harvest of last year was very good. But there was no claim that the total harvest were good. And usually, when there are no claims of very good development, then this means that the developments are perhaps not particularly impressive. In general, therefore, we must say that economically 1967 was probably a worse year than 1966. Now, in the long run, how much damage the economy suffered from the Cultural Revolution in 67 may be far less important than the fact that Mr. Mao and his followers had to call upon the PLA to provide the necessary support for the economy, and that the PLA's initial intervention in the early part of 67 had proved insufficient. As a matter of fact, the PLA's new role generated greater resistance, which in its turn has induced even greater repression. Illustrative of the state of affairs was an appeal by a small group in September 1967 who worked on the railway administration in Inner Mongolia. And here in this appeal to the public, this group made a few urgent points, and I quote, "One, no one is allowed to break into military organizations, military units of a confidential nature, or military warehouses. No one is allowed to direct the spearhead of struggle against the great PLA. Two, again I quote, no organization or individual is allowed to incite peasants to enter cities or workers to go to the countryside to engage in beating, looting, smashing, and arresting. And third, again I quote, guns and ammunition of mass organizations, except those which have special approval from the Party Central Committee, shall be turned in immediately and kept by local PLA units. It would appear that things were not all entirely under control. Now, the Maoist response to these difficulties encountered by the PLA was to give the latter even greater responsibility. On October 17, 1967, not too long ago, the Communist Party Central Committee, the State Council of the People's Republic, the Military Affairs Committee of the Party Central Committee, the Cultural Revolution Group of the Central Committee, in other words, all the organizations that act really hold power in China, instructed all factories, schools, department and enterprise units to follow the principles of revolution and to form revolutionary great alliances. This was on October 17th, and on the following day, the Military Affairs Committee, which controls the army, further instructed all the PLA members to, I quote, help the left, help industry and agriculture, exercise military control, and give political and military training in the factories, countryside, and schools. In other words, the PLA's new role was to be the unifying force to enforce conformity and provide the organizing focus for a country in disarray. And one conclusion would seem to be obvious, that is, regardless of how the Cultural Revolution is to end, and it's supposed to end very fairly soon, according to the announced schedule, the military will assume ascendancy. The influence of the military will be paramount. And from this, we can draw two further conclusions. In the first place, the military, along with all types, actually along with all types of possible communist leadership in Peking, can be expected to follow the established policy. And as stressed, it is an established policy which is shared by all party leaderships, the established policy of continuing nuclear weapons development. And this is one thing that they all agree upon, and the military will surely try to carry it out. Secondly, the military and those of the Maoist persuasion especially can be expected to pursue with all energy the strategy of the People's War. Reference may be made to the restatement by Marshal Ling Biao, who is billed as the closest comrade in arms of Chairman Mao and his present heir apparent. Reference may be made to Ling Biao's restatement in September 1965 of the Doctrine of People's War, which foresees the overthrow of Western citadels of power by the oppressed peoples of the world. And I choose to describe this, and as Ling did, to use the term people's war, because it is more than a war of national liberation. A war of national liberation would connote the idea that it is essentially an effort by a group against some foreign imperialist national oppression. But a people's war is supposed to be a war by the oppressed against the oppressors. And this sees no national boundaries. What we see, therefore, in Chinese military policy is the development of nuclear weapons, and according to many of us, for the purpose of giving China a deterrent. In other words, most of us do not see China as developing nuclear weapons in order to attack the United States. China is trying to develop weapons in order to eliminate even the remotest possibility of the U.S. using nuclear weapons, and perhaps the Soviet Union ever using nuclear weapons against China. But given such a nuclear deterrent, there would be followed, and simply note in passing, just a couple of points. One, what do the Chinese think to be an effective deterrent? What would they have before they think that the United States or the Soviet Union, especially the United States, would not be able to use nuclear weapons against China? My own conclusion is that what the Chinese communists believe is that they must have a capability of attacking, not destroying, but merely attacking the United States in her homeland. It must be a possibility to deliver a weapon to continental United States. For this reason, therefore, we would envisage the development of ICBMs and perhaps of submarine warfare. Submarine-launched missiles. And the reasoning behind this is that the Chinese probably believe that even the slightest possibility of damage within the United States would be a sufficient political deterrent to any U.S. administration, that it is not necessary to be able to destroy the United States. And the second point I might note in passing is that the kind of military expenditure and technological development necessary for such a program, a relatively limited program, are well within Chinese capability. The Cultural Revolution has not affected it and is not expected to affect it. Now let me come to the last part of the Chinese strategy. Given the possibility of pursuing people's war, how do you go about it? In this connection, I might point out what has been one essence in the Cultural Revolution. The Cultural Revolution has stressed the importance of a great leap in thought. That is, to think the unthinkable, to break out of the conventional bondage of thinking in such a case. The Maoists have pointed out the effect of this. They say, look at our nuclear development. People said that we couldn't do it in such a short time, but we did it. We did it by revolutionary means, by bypassing certain procedures, by doing things in a different way. And so, by the same token, if you were sitting in Peking and you look at the outside world, you see frustration in Vietnam, and I must say that Vietnam is a frustration to Peking as well, and you see frustration across the Formosa Strait. You see everywhere an American presence and a Soviet presence. And you look at this American presence especially. You say, now, what can we do? Now, obviously, if you're trying to solve every problem by piecemeal, you get frustrated again. That's how you got frustrated in the first place. The only way to leap over this wall is to bring down the United States directly. If, in some way, the United States could be rendered impotent, then all the other problems would disappear. So this is the way, really, the approach you should be thinking about. And I might quote you two Chinese quotations about war. One says that if you want to attack the enemy, the way to attack an enemy is to attack his mind, his attitude. And another saying is that if you want to catch all the robbers, then catch the chieftain. What is the concept of all this in connection with what is the meaning of all this in connection with another concept? That is the concept of the paper tiger. The Chinese have always said the United States is a paper tiger. It has to be respected tactically because it has nuclear teeth, but it is to be despised strategically, because it is incapable of doing two things. It is incapable of using the weapons in which it has superiority, and it lacks the will to persist in doing what it is capable of doing. And in this connection, again, let me, in conclusion, read to you two little passages. One was a statement on August 8, 1963 by Mr. Mao in response to a request by Mr. Robert Williams, who had taken refuge in Cuba and who had asked Mr. Mao to pronounce on Chinese attitudes toward American Negroes in their struggle. And he pointed out in this connection, or Mr. Mao stated in this connection, that in the final analysis, a national struggle is a question of class struggle. In the United States, it is only the reactionary ruling circles among the whites who are oppressing the Negro people. They can in no way represent the workers, farmers, revolutionary intellectuals, and other enlightened persons who comprise the overwhelming majority of the white people. At present, it is the handful of imperialists headed by the United States and their supporters, the reactionaries in different countries who are practicing oppression and aggression and making threats against the overwhelming majority of the nations and peoples of the world. We are in the majority, they are, and they are in the minority, unquote. Now, more recently, in August 1966, in a big Peking rally, the People's Daily, the official organ, stated in an editorial about the racial unrest in the United States. It said one of the outstanding, the most outstanding characteristic is that the black people, I'm translating, the black people of the United States have more and more broadened their self-defense by violence. That the landmark of the movement is the recognition that revolution has to be by violence. What we see, therefore, is the possible mutual support and mutual reinforcement. Reinforcement in their belief of the correctness of their approach between Peking and the dissident elements in the United States and elsewhere. We see this mutual support and mutual reinforcement as a factor which must lead to protracted conflict. Now, if we look at the situation in Vietnam, even a Korea-type solution there, which probably would be the best that the administration would hope for, would not solve the problem. It's not that the administration is not doing what is necessary. I'm not arguing that we're doing the wrong things. It is that the administration is not doing enough. Even if it is doing what is necessary, the best it can accomplish would not solve the problem. We cannot expect the stoppage of one people's war to mark the end of all people's wars. What we need to do, really, is to turn the table around and to stop endorsing the status quo in communist countries. Thank you.